This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehius Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Between January 1999 and July 2020, at least 600 terror attacks took place in the country that led to at least 1,300 deaths.
That's Juliet Kamu, an independent security consultant in Nairobi, who says terrorism continues to be a major problem in Kenya, despite the government's efforts to fight it. Details coming up. Also, the U.S. Embassy in Uganda says the country has agreed to open its doors to 2,000 Afghan evacuees. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Algeria has accused Morocco of becoming a platform for foreign powers to criticize it, referring to a statement by the visiting Israeli foreign minister who accused Algeria of collaborating with Iran against Morocco. Algeria's foreign minister on Tuesday also accused Morocco's leaders of responsibility of repeated crisis and behavior that has led to conflict instead of integration in North Africa. William Lawrence, professor of international relations at the American University in Washington, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the timing of these accusations and the impact of Algeria severing diplomatic ties with Morocco on stability in North Africa.
Well, let me address the accusations first. It's significant that each country is accusing the other, with Morocco now backed by Israel and Algeria taking great umbrage that Morocco is backed by Israel, of being the regional destabilizer and engendering conflict. And in that respect, I would say it takes two to tango. In any conflictual situation between two countries, it's very common for each country to blame the other country for conflict and destabilization, when in fact both countries share at least some of the blame. Another way to think of this is car crashes. Usually in a car crash, both drivers are to some degree responsible, even if one driver is more responsible than another. And it's the same thing in conflicts between countries. Both countries could usually have done more to avoid conflict. And right now, it seems that one side is seeking conflict and the other one is responding. That's why we have diplomacy. That's why we have ruptures in diplomatic relations that can presage a war or they can replace a war. You just express your dissatisfaction, you recall your ambassador, you shut down your embassy, whatever, instead of a full-blown war. So that remains to be seen. Morocco wants the world to recognize its annexation of Western Sahara in the 1970s, and Algeria wants the world to recognize Western Saharan right to self-determination. And they both want to achieve these goals without war, as they've shown over the last 40-something years. But the timing has to do with the end of the Trump administration and its moves with the Abrahamic Accords, which have emboldened Morocco and set Israel in motion in the region. And then these other aggravating factors like climate change this summer, the pandemic, and the global economic downturn. As for the factors that'll light the match in such a situation, as for the triggers, you know, there's always arsonists. And if the forest is dry enough and ready to be lit, it will usually catch on fire.
So how would that escalation between Algeria and Morocco impact the security in North Africa?
Well, it's been negatively impacting the security in North Africa for decades, in part because the international community and the African community would like Morocco and Algeria, which have two of the largest armed forces and capabilities, both in the military sphere and the non-military sphere, playing a stabilizing role in North Africa when they don't. We also have one of the most closed borders in the world between Algeria and Morocco, which not only affects the security situation in North Africa devastatingly, but the economic situation as well, knocking a couple of points off the GDP of each country because there's no trade. It's the least traded situation in the world. But when most countries think of the overall security situation, it's the Sahel. And Morocco has a positive role to play in Sahel conflicts and terrorism. Algeria has a positive role to play. And the stabilizing effects on the Sahel would be much greater if Morocco and Algeria were cooperating. I suspect with the latest breakdown in diplomatic negotiations, some level of intelligence cooperation will continue to work between the two countries. And of course, both countries cooperate with the United States and France. But certainly, you know, when Morocco and Algeria are focusing on their own conflict rather than larger regional stabilization, a lot of things can go wrong. And, you know, there are other factors which we haven't talked about, but the migration crisis, which affects the Sahel, North Africa, and Europe, gets worse when the countries aren't cooperating, because a lot of those migrants, you know, come up through Algeria and cross into Morocco or vice versa, or get sent back. And if the countries aren't cooperating, the migration as an aggravating factor gets worse as well. So what we all want is for Algeria and Morocco to start cooperating in ways both countries have been pledging for years, but the Western Sahara disagreement continues to aggravate things.
That was William Lawrence, professor of international relations at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. The U.S. Embassy in Uganda says the country has agreed to open its doors to 2,000 Afghan evacuees after receiving 51 this week. Uganda earlier agreed to temporarily host what it called at-risk Afghan nationals and other nationals who are in transit to the U.S. and other destinations worldwide. Hakainde Hichilema took office Tuesday as Zambia's new president nearly 2 weeks after the country's national election. He defeated incumbent Edgar Lungu, who conceded defeat after threatening to challenge the election results. Last week, VOA's Peter Cloete sat down for a lengthy interview with President Hichilema. Today, we bring the third of three parts of the interview.
Mr. President, people have suffered during the previous administration. You suffered as well during the campaign period.
Yes.
There were restrictions, clampdown, yes, civil liberties, radio stations, TV stations were shut down, among other things. I heard there is even a petition putting pressure on you to act. Some people say they even want a pound of flesh. What is your message to them, Mr. President?
No, look, all I can say is that there was a failure of leadership. Failure of leadership, sometimes violence, was used to scare people and along the way commit heinous crimes. There was a perception that if you use force, then you stay in power. Mm. We have proved that wrong, because I could not access, as you rightly say, airspace using my own arrangements, my own facilities. That's taken away my right, my freedom of movement. How I move by bicycle, by walking, by air, is no one's business. But that was taken away from us. So many negatives. I'm sure you remember, at one point I couldn't enter a town. Mm-hmm. My own town? And I asked the question, why should I not enter this town? Since when did I need a passport to enter this town? I don't want to continue articulating those issues, but I want to say that that's over. Mm. Citizens should be comfortable that that is over. These restrictions have already been lifted even before we're sworn in, but we'll reinforce the rule of law, which I talked about, we'll reinforce respect for people's rights. Mm-hmm. We will also make sure that we take away draconianism. There will be no abuse of the Public Order Act. The way it is, as amended by the Supreme Court, after a transgression on the interpretation of the Public Order Act, one courageous lady went to court and got a Supreme Court ruling to interpret the Public Order Act properly, which was deliberately being misconstrued, that you need a permit from the police to hold a meeting. The Supreme Court ruled that you don't need a permit. You don't need permission. You don't need anyone to authorize you or not. You just need to notify the police. Because we're victims of it, we know how it hurts. We know. Mm-hmm. We will not allow other people to go through the pain we've gone through.
Mm-hmm. Mr. President, what role do you think Zambia can play under your leadership in promoting democracy within the SADC region and by extension Africa, as you mentioned?
We think that we have already sent a signal that we are a child of democracy. We are a product of democracy. A very Basically, you can call us, we achieved what Napoleon couldn't, a mission impossible. You arrested this way, that way, that. You can't campaign. You still win the way we want. So it means we sent a message to Bilzan that opportunities on the flip side. Here there was basically squalor, poverty, hunger, unemployment. The year, no self-medicines. Here, essentially, violence. Here is the ills. Here is the opportunity. That's what we offer. If we're a product of democracy, free will of the people, and we got elected under all odds, against all odds, honestly, we are a good example of how democracy must evolve, even under brutal conditions. So I think what we did, what the people of Zambia did, my brother, in the last couple of days, of course, culminating, mm-hmm. Over years, building up to what it was. I'm sure other African countries are watching. And they're saying, no, we can do it the way Zambia did it. Mm-hmm. And we would like to support, to share our experiences with those African countries.
That was Zambia's president, Hakainde Hichilema, speaking with Peter Cloete, the host of VOA's Nightline Africa program. Kenya has one of the oldest counter-terrorism frameworks in Africa, having developed it after the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi in August 1998. The blast, coordinated by Al-Qaeda, killed 213 people and injured thousands. A new report by the International Relations Department at South Africa's Wits University finds that terrorism remains a major threat to Kenya and that the country's anti-terrorist strategies haven't made it a safe place. Darren Taylor has more.
Kenya has a long list of laws to combat extremism, including the Prevention of Terrorism Act. Its government has established several specialized security agencies, including the Anti-Terror Police Unit and the National Counter-Terrorism Center. It's built a wall on its border with Somalia to try to stop members of the Al-Shabaab terror group from crossing into its territory.
In spite of all these measures, terror attacks continue. Between January 1999 and July 2020, at least 600 terror attacks took place in the country that led to at least 1,300 deaths.
Juliet Kamau is an independent security consultant based in Nairobi. She's been analyzing Kenya's response to terror for more than a decade. In a webinar held by Wits University, Kamau said terrorists in Kenya are mainly targeting the country's security forces.
To put this into perspective, in the last 1 month, there have been at least 5 terror attacks that have cost the lives of at least 16 security officers, 3 police reservists, and 2 civilians.
She says Al-Shabaab remains the biggest terror threat to East Africa.
We see Al-Shabaab targeting Kenya for the following reasons: Kenya's involvement in counterterrorism, Kenya's perceived successes. We see Kenya as an open country. It has quick and free media, good communication networks, tourist industry is thriving. And lastly, the borders between Kenya and its neighbors are very porous, while the people that live along the borders are homogeneous.
She says it's therefore easy for extremists to blend in with locals. According to Kamau's analysis, terrorists affiliated to Islamic State, or IS, are increasingly active in countries close to Kenya, including Somalia, Mozambique, and Democratic Republic of Congo.
What these groups' activities portend for Kenya in the coming years include more terror attacks, insurgency in the larger parts of northeastern region of Kenya and the coast region of Kenya as Al-Shabaab seeks to expand its reach, IS presence in providing aspiring jihadists with more options. They have now more terror theaters to participate in, and self-radicalization and recruitment will continue through the social media network.
She points out that Kenyan troops have been in Somalia fighting a seemingly intractable war against Al-Shabaab for almost a decade.
From day one, we've seen Al-Shabaab saying that Kenya will be a target as long as it remains in Somalia.
Kamau says after Al-Shabaab attacked the Westgate Mall in Nairobi in 2013, the government launched a plan for all security agencies to cooperate against terrorism, each using its specific skills.
This is where we see police, the military and intelligence trying to work together, but they all have different reporting lines, different training, different funding and all that. So it makes it very hard for them to collaborate effectively.
She says given the results so far, Kenyans are justified in questioning the value of their government strategy of taking the war to the terrorists.
Indeed, most countermeasures adopted have provoked, continued, and even increased terrorist activities from terror elements.
Kamau concludes that Kenya will continue to be threatened by terrorism as long as its strategy to combat it remains uncoordinated. Of even greater concern, she says, is there are few signs of peace and stability being established in nearby countries such as Somalia, which provide excellent bases for terrorists to use to plan and launch attacks in Kenya. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Criticism is mounting against South African President Cyril Ramaphosa, with some even within his own party calling on him to step down. He is accused of paying lip service to the fight against corruption and giving the opposition ammunition by failing to turn around the still deteriorating economy and record high inflation. Tusokumalo reports from Johannesburg.
When Ramaphosa was first sworn in as president in 2018, he introduced his administration as a new dawn. He promised to deal with corruption, crime and poverty, restore trust in public institutions, and invigorate economic growth and investment to create enough jobs for all South Africans who need them. However, 3 years later, a recent survey by Afrobarometer, a research network that measures public attitudes, shows that fewer than 40% of South Africans trust him. Mikali Musa, South African Reconciliation Barometer project leader, spoke to reporters about these results.
Trust in the president is actually very, very low at the moment in 2021. So this is quite worrying in terms of the president having a mandate or public approval for a lot of the tough reforms that he's going to have to implement over the next few years in order to recover from the devastating effects of the pandemic.
Although Ramaphosa has spoken tough on corruption, no high-ranking party official, former or current cabinet minister has been jailed for corruption, even though it remains the biggest threat to the country's progress. And Musilo Mutepo, a whistleblower who exposed gross corruption involving plundering of state resources, told the media that corruption busters have no protection from the government.
I've had to take various steps with regards to my own personal safety. I don't take the same route twice. There's no location on my phone. I try to Uber. So it's also mental awareness, but it takes away your peace of mind as well.
Ramaphosa's inability to turn around the economy took another hit as the unemployment rate jumped to a record high of 34.4%. Julius Malema, leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party, had no kind words for him during a media briefing this week.
The people of South Africa are currently leaderless. The levels of poverty and unemployment in South Africa are deepening and everything is getting worse. This anti-black government cannot guarantee access to basic services such as water and electricity. The extent and levels of unemployment in South Africa is at a crisis level.
Many have added the growing energy crisis to Ramaphosa's poor performance list. While he promised to build a stronger and united ruling African National Congress, ANC, the party is suffering huge divisions. As if that isn't enough, party spokesperson Pule Mabe told reporters that the ANC is struggling to pay its workers.
The ANC, like all other political parties, has been hardest hit by the kind of economic situation that we find ourselves in because of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Most state-owned enterprises are still struggling, with some already under business rescue programs. Political analyst Prince Mashele told VOA that Ramaphosa is no better than his predecessor, Jacob Zuma, who is in jail for refusing to testify before a commission investigating alleged massive corruption during his tenure.
There are some in society who would like to project him as Mr. Clean. But we know that there are all manner of dodgy characters who contributed money to Cyril Ramaphosa to become president of the ANC. In other words, and that is not different, by the way, from the Guptas influencing Jacob Zuma.
However, he still commands a lot of support, especially within the business community, where he's seen to be pro-business and doing more to fight corruption than his predecessor. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Nigeria's largest city, Lagos, is clearing the streets and arresting thousands of street beggars in what authorities call an effort to curb robbery and other social vices. Munachi Chooks from Abuja, Nigeria, takes a look at reaction from some Nigerians.
A special team has been set up by the Ministry of Youth and Social Development in conjunction with the police to curb the menace. The Commissioner for Lagos Police, Hakim Odumosu, told a news conference that his command would enforce the sweep.
It is our responsibility to enforce all laws. Legal limit is a price we need to pay for infrastructure development and better living environments. And so a couple of people have seen that opportunity of that terminal, so they are attacking. It's turning as if they are begging for arms. It's turning as if they are selling.
The Lagos State Commissioner for Information and Strategy, Gbenga Omotosho, told VOA that the ban and arrest of hawkers and beggars was due to the incessant complaints by residents.
It has a security implications. People complaining that they get robbed by people who pretend to be beggars. And then some people who are dehumanizing people by sending them onto the street to go and beg. And they make a lot of money out of this. So the government is bent on stopping that nonsense.
Omotosho added that considering the security situation of the country, government needs to do all it can to secure lives and property. In an interview with VOA, Lagos-based journalist Lekan Otufodorin commended the state government for making the move to curb the menace of street begging and criminality.
I've always been worried about the menace of beggars and hawkers in Lagos. And so, for me, I think the plan by the Lagos government to take them off the street is very commendable. For all I know, they have become a big nuisance.
The executive director of Sea Hope Nigeria, Betty Abba, had a contrary view. She advised the government to make alternative provisions to enable hawkers and beggars to survive.
The Lagos state government, in order to reduce or to even eradicate street begging and street hawking, should provide alternatives, provide welfare for the vast majority of the impoverished masses, provide specified trading areas so that people don't have to hawk in streets.
Street trading and begging have become a huge business in most cities in Nigeria, especially Lagos. There have been reports that beggars and hawkers, both children and adults, are transported regularly from other parts of the country to Lagos. For VOA News, Munachi Chooks.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC.